Good evening, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 22nd, in the year 2000. Tonight, in our fireside room, we are pleased to have as our presenter, Volker Greifenhagen, who will be continuing and finalizing his series on Abraham's Offspring, An Introduction to Islam for Christians. Tonight's presentation is entitled Abraham's Sacrifice in the Quran and in the Bible. And tonight's presentation is numbered GRV 2000-6. Let's listen in.
Well, I think we'll start here since it's 6:20 or a little afterwards. This session is going to be taped, as most of them are. So I just want to announce the title of this session for the sake of the tape. This is Abraham's Offspring, An Introduction to Islam for Christians. And this is a session that I guess we could call Ishmael Instructs Isaac, The Quran for Bible Readers, Part 2, because we've done one of these before. And as I've done in previous sessions, I like to begin with an invocation. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, most merciful, most compassionate, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, most compassionate, most merciful. Now, any of you who were here yesterday and heard me know that this invocation are the first three verses of the Quran, which is the scripture of Islam. And yet most Christian audiences, you know, immediately say, oh, those sound like words that express things that I believe, and I could easily say those words, and so on. So I'd like to use that as an introduction. However, we have to have a joke first, right? How many have been here last week? Oh, one person only. So it doesn't matter. I can use a joke I used before, right?
Okay. It helps me remember.
It has to be a sort of a religious joke, right? So, okay, three guys end up at the pearly gates. They've just died. And St. Peter meets them. He says, oh, that's a terrible mistake. We didn't expect three people. We only have room for one right now. So I can only accept one of you. The other two, you're going to have to wait out here until we have some more room ready. But I don't know how to you know, choose which one of you gets to go in. And he had an idea. He said, well, each of you, you'll tell me the story of how you died. And whosever story is the most fascinating and most interesting and astounding, I'll let that person in. So he gestures to one person. He says, well, you begin. And the guy says, well, you know, I was sure my wife was cheating on me. So I went to work one day and I snuck back home to the apartment, ran to the apartment, and there she was lying in bed, and I knew the guy must be around there someplace. So I looked through the whole apartment, I opened the closets, looked under the couches and everything. I was running, couldn't find anybody. Suddenly I heard this banging noise from the kitchen. I went into the kitchen and it was coming from the window. So I opened the window up, and there was a guy hanging from by his fingertips on the finger ledge, trying to kind of crawl up. I said, ah, I got you. And I took a frying pan and mashed his fingers, and he plummeted 5 stories down into the bushes below. And I looked down, and I saw he was still moving. So I dragged the fridge over to the window, and I pushed the fridge out. And just as the fridge tipped out, it caught on my belt, pulled me out after it. Bang, here I am. St. Peter was incredulous. He said, wow, that is an amazing story. I don't think anybody's going to be able to top that. So he said, okay, to the second person, you tell your story. Second person said, so I was washing windows on this apartment building about 10 stories up, and suddenly one of the ropes holding up my little thing that I was standing on slipped and tipped like this, and I'm plummeting down, you know, from 10 stories up. And luckily, I just grabbed onto a window ledge about halfway down, and I was hanging there, and all of a sudden the window opened, some idiot started banging on my fingertips with a frying pan, and I plunged down the rest of the 5 stories, landed in the bushes, and I thought I was a goner, and I went, and suddenly I realized that I was alive, and I looked up to see a fridge coming down. St. Peter says, wow! That's an amazing story. That's just incredible. I don't think any of us can be able to top that one. So just the third person says, you tell your story. He says, well, I was hiding in this refrigerator. Okay, my name is Volker Greifenhagen. And I teach religious studies at a place called Luther College at the University of Regina. I'm wearing my Luther College t-shirt and my Luther College hat. So I've done my advertising for my college. It's in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada. And I teach in the Department of Religious Studies, and my main area is Islamic studies. I also teach some Hebrew Bible and general surveys of world religions and so on. So I have an academic interest in this subject area. And by the way, I'm positioned here because of the overhead, so I'm not intentionally turning my back on anyone. It's just the way the room's set up. So I have this academic interest in this subject, but I'm also an ordained pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. I've worked in campus ministry, taught at the seminary a little bit, and done a fair amount of preaching in congregations and so on. So I have also a pastoral interest in this subject of Islam and of this religion that I think Christians, it's very important for Christians to know more about this religion. And I'm going to give you three, perhaps four reasons for that. This is a little bit of a repeat. How many were here yesterday for? So some of you. So this, you'll pass the test a lot easier because you'll hear some of this as another one around. First of all, just in sheer numbers, Islam is the second largest religion in the world after Christianity, and it's the fastest growing religion in the world. In North America, for instance, Islam is growing very rapidly, such that probably in 5 years or so, the number of Muslims, if not already, will have outstripped the number of Jews in North America, and Islam will also in North America be the second largest religious group. All this is to say that Muslims are our neighbors. They're not going to be far away exotic people, but more and more they're going to be people living next door to you, who have houses of worship or mosques in your town, who you work with, who your kids play with, who you go to school with or whatever. It's just not going to be an exotic other thing. It's going to be something that you'll encounter right there. And you know, part of our mandate as Christians is to know our neighbors and to serve our neighbors, and so it behooves us to know something about these neighbors that we will encounter more and more. A second important reason, and we spent a lot of time in our session yesterday on this, is of course the prominence that Islam has had in the news media. And it's usually been a fairly negative image of Islam, of course. Whenever there's some sort of violent thing happening in the Middle East or so, often the words Islam or Muslim get mixed up with that coverage. And so it's not surprising that many people in North America, when they think of the words Muslim or Islam, it conjures up negative images of terrorists or fanatics or something like that. Or of the oppression of women, that's the veiled women. Is the other, like, you know, the terrorist or the veiled woman. Those are the two images often associated with Islam. Well, you know, again, if, you know, how true are these? Are these, accurate? Is this a distortion? Is this a stereotype? So it's very important to know that Christians know about Islam to get beyond the stereotypes, because we don't want to be stereotyped either. We don't want everybody thinking that we're murderous, terrorist-type people because what people did, what Christians did in Rwanda, or what they did in North Ireland. Okay? So we don't want to be stereotyped either. But thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, is that Muslims are cousins in our family. Just like Jews and Christians, Muslims also trace their spiritual ancestry back to Abraham. They claim Abraham as their forefather in the faith. And we're part of the same family. But as you all know, you can treat members of your own family in ways you would never treat anybody outside of the family. It's been sort of a dysfunctional family that has been fighting a lot. So maybe it's time to, you know, try to repair some of the ruptures and get to know these distant family members again. I came across a illustration that I found really interesting. So we can focus this a bit better. This is an illustration from a Bible that was published in France in the 12th century. So that's a long time ago, when we think people weren't too enlightened. Everything, but it is a picture of Abraham's bosom, Abraham's lap, in other words. And gathered in that lap This is you can know this if you know the artistic conventions of the time are Christians, Jews, and Muslims. They're all in Abraham's bosom together here. So this is kind of a nice image. I was very surprised to find it and gratified to find it of this kind of getting the family together again. Of course, the fourth reason that I sometimes bring up is that without Islam, there might have never been anything like a Lutheran church or a Protestant movement at all, at least a successful one. Historically, one of the reasons that the Reformation probably was allowed to succeed is because the Turks at that time, which were a Muslim nation, were coming up in Eastern Europe. They had taken over Hungary and they were besieging Vienna in 1529. That's right in the middle of all of Luther's activity and stuff like that. And it's quite likely that the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, I think it was, I can't remember. Charles V, was constrained against really, you know, stamping out the Reformation because he needed all the help he could get from even the evangelical princes and counts and whatever to help, you know, kind of be prepared for further incursions on that frontier. So it's likely that, you know, a lot of stuff might not have happened if the Turks hadn't been there. Okay, today what I'd like to introduce to you is the Quran. That's what our session is on, the Quran, which is the scripture or the holy book of Islam. Let's just put this on here. Okay, this is the proper transliteration of the word. You may have seen it often spelled K-O-R-A-N. That was sort of conventionally used. Nowadays, we try to be a little bit more accurate in how we transliterate words from foreign languages, and this is a more accurate representation of that word. Now, you know, Qurans are readily available. You can come across a Quran. This is a copy of the Quran that I brought with me, and this is a copy that's, this is probably the kind of Quran that's most commonly used in North American English-speaking Muslim homes. All right. Now you might notice something very interesting. I can't show it to you close up. But do you see what sort of the title is? Is this titled the Holy Quran, or is it titled something else? It's entitled The Meaning of the Holy Quran. Now there's a little bit of a clue there that, at least to Muslim sensibilities, the Quran in this form isn't really quite the complete Quran. It's the meaning of the Quran, but not the Quran itself. Let's look on the inside of it. You'll see this is a typical page layout. You probably are used to study Bibles and stuff like that. But what is the big difference between a study Bible and the way this is laid out? What's different?
Two languages.
Yeah, you have two languages. You have on the right-hand column, you have the original Arabic text, and in the left-hand column, you have an English translation. Then you have notes and stuff, but you're familiar with that stuff from study Bibles. The big difference is that the Arabic is here together with the English. Now, you can get English translations of the Quran that don't have any of that. But Muslim translations or translations of the Quran that are used by Muslims usually and almost invariably will have the Arabic text there. Okay? Now, there's a reason for that. The reason is that Muslims believe that the Quran, as it was revealed through the Prophet Muhammad, they believe that to be literally the word of God, the speech of God. Okay? Now, it's not that God speaks Arabic, you know, exclusively or anything, but it happened that this revelation is believed to have come to Muhammad, who was an Arab, and spoke Arabic. All right? Now, any of you who know more than one language, you know that if you ever try to translate from one language to another, especially if it's a joke that involves a pun or a play on words, it's really difficult to do, if not impossible. And even translating something ordinary, sometimes it's very difficult. There's inevitably some loss involved in translating from one language to another. And Muslims have recognized that. And so they try to preserve the Arabic, the original Arabic of the Quran as much as possible. So that what is meant by the meaning of the Holy Quran is the English translation. That can't really be the Quran because it's not. There's something that has been lost in the translation. The Arabic is the true meaning of the Quran. But even this printed Arabic is not really the Quran. The word Quran means recitation. And that's a clue. It's something that, it's not something that you read. It's not marks on the page that you, you know, you sort of inwardly digest, but it's something that you hear. Okay. So the Quran primarily is something that you hear. The text was written down only to facilitate oral proclamation or oral recitation or oral chanting of this text. Muhammad is traditionally considered to have been illiterate and not to have been able to write any of this down. The standard Muslim story of the origins of the Quran is that beginning in 610, Muhammad had these experiences where these words would come by divine intervention to him. He would learn them, he would repeat them to his followers who had memorized them, and so you got a huge community of Muslims who had memorized progressively more and more of what's now eventually in this book. But it was kept as an oral phenomenon. Now, eventually, little bits and pieces were written down, and in order to facilitate people not, you know, making mistakes when they recited the text, eventually it was all brought together into one book called the Holy Quran. But even then, it remained largely an oral phenomenon. And that's true of the majority of the Muslim world today. When one goes and hears, one doesn't go to read the Quran, one goes to hear the Quran. Because Muslims, now this comes right down to the nub of it. Muslims believe, or Orthodox Muslims would believe, that when the Quran is recited in Arabic, according to the correct pronunciation, you are literally hearing the voice of God. Okay? And Muslims can be overcome with emotion at hearing that text, even if they don't, you know, aren't native Arabic speakers. The rhythm and the whole context in which this is done overcomes them with emotion. The Quran is about as long as the New Testament, and there are a lot of Muslims in the world who have memorized the whole thing. Not in English or in whatever language, but in Arabic. So imagine you setting out to memorize the New Testament, not in English, but in its original Greek. Okay, so this is how highly the original text is prized and how important the hearing it through your ears is. And I thought in order to show you that, let me just give you a few other things, and then I have a recording of some Quranic recitation. So you know it means reading or recitation. The book form of the Quran is divided up into 114 chapters, or they're called surahs, each of which is then further divided into ayahs, or verses. The word ayah is very interesting because it means sign. So each verse of the Quran is seen as a sign of God, some sort of revelation of God. The ayahs of God aren't restricted to the Quran. Muslims also speak, like here in Holden Village, all the nature that's around us, the mountains and the trees, would be seen as ayahs of God. They're also revealing the Creator's power and goodness and so on. Some of you maybe have heard the word ayatollah. Now, you know what ayah means. Do you know, can you figure out what ayatollah means? What's...
Revelation
of God, because Allah is the Arabic word for God, all right? Sort of like we say God, or Germans say Dieu. Frenchmen say Dieu, and Germans say Gott. Allah is the word for God, so Ayatollah means sign of God, okay? And this is a sign, this is a title that's given to the most esteemed religious teachers in Shia Islam, which is a particular branch of Islam that's particularly found in Iran. We all heard about Ayatollah because of Ayatollah Khomeini, of course. Right. Okay, The first surah of the Quran is I'll just introduce that one because we'll hear that on recitation. It's called, each of the surahs or chapters of the Quran are given a title. And so Muslims don't refer to chapter 7 of the Quran, they'll refer to Surah Fatiha or Surah Al-Baqarah or whatever the title of the surah is. This one is called the Fatiha, which just makes sense, it's the opening chapter of the Quran. The arrangement of chapters in the Quran is mainly from longest to shortest. Okay, so it's very frustrating. If you ever want to pick up the Quran and read it, and you're a person used to reading biblical stuff, you'll be absolutely frustrated. Because you'll expect, your creation's at the beginning, and then we have a history, and then we'll throw some laws in, and you know, it kind of goes along, right? No way, not in the Quran. I mean, these things were put together, and the chapters were kind of lined up one after the other in sort of descending length, with the exception of this opening one. That's a little short one. But then you have a chapter that goes on for almost 300 verses, Al-Baqarah, and then there's another long one. So if you ever want to read the Quran, probably read it backwards is the best way. You'll read the short, little, very poetic and poignant surahs at the end, the real ones with little whammies, and then get progressively to the longer ones that are more involved. The Quran also jumps around a lot. It doesn't have, very few places does it have a connected narrative. The only exception is chapter 12, which is Surah Al-Yusuf, which is the story of Joseph. And that's a good one to look at too, but it's just too long for us to do tonight. So what I'd like to do is, I'll show you a Surah Al-Fatiha out of this copy of the Quran that I have. And again, you'll see you have both sides. You have the Arabic side on one side, and you have the English translation on the other. Is that fairly... There we go. Okay, you can see there's a Surah 1, there's a title, the opening. Most of the chapters of the Quran are subtitled where they were revealed. Whether they were revealed while Muhammad was still a prophet in Mecca, or whether they were revealed after the Muslim community in Mecca emigrated to Medina. So there, it'll often say revealed at Mecca, or revealed at Medina. And then you have the text of the surah. We'll just go very quickly through this because it gives you this. You'll recognize immediately this is the text, at least the first few verses of this I used as the invocation. Okay? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. This phrase begins every chapter of the Quran except for one. In the name of God, it's translated many different ways, beneficent, the merciful, or the compassionate, the merciful. The root word here, Rahman and Rahim, is related to the word for womb. It's the same word used in Hebrew for compassion, for expressing compassion. It's womb feeling, all right? This compassion. So I always like to bring that up because one of the stereotypes that's... sometimes believed by Westerners about Islam is that the Islamic God or the belief, the kind of God that Muslims, or the way Muslims portray God is very harsh and demanding and judgmental. And yet, this is the most common way of portraying God as compassionate and merciful. And then continues, praise be to Allah, Lord of the worlds. Now, God's compassionate and merciful, but remember, God's also in charge. So you have the double nature of God, okay? You've got God's mercy, you've got God's control. He's the creator, he's the Lord of the worlds. Worlds, not just this world, but any world, all of reality. But don't forget verse 3 or ayah 3, the beneficent, the merciful, just so you don't forget that, it keeps coming up again. And then owner of the day of judgment. There you have the other side. So in those first four verses, you see a nice flip-flop back and forth between the two sides of God, compassion and judgment. Okay, God is merciful, forgiving. On the other hand, God also calls human beings to account. Okay, so for instance, on the day of judgment. And this is very interesting because this surah begins with God, and that's where Muslims like to begin. They don't like to begin, what's the human predicament or anything. They want to begin with, what's God about? This is God. But then how does God relate to human beings? So we have in ayah 5, or verse 5, a kind of transition to the human realm. How are humans to relate to this reality, which is God? You alone we worship, You alone we ask for help. By the way, when you see something in brackets like that, it's something that the translator added to give clarity to the text. It's not something you'll find literally in the Arabic text itself, right? So, what's the proper stance of human beings to God? Worship, on the one hand, you know, the awe-inspiring nature of God. And then also, but you can also ask God for help. Okay, ask God, implore God for help. What kind of help? How do you do that? The last two verses show you. What do you ask for? God, show us the straight path. Okay, show us the straight path. Show us the path that you want us to walk on so that we will have and enjoy life as you intended. Because Muslims believe that everyone's born sort of knowing what that path is, knowing that that path involves submitting your will to God's will. That's what Islam is really about. But, you know, we're forgetful and we're ungrateful. And so we tend to deviate off this path, sort of go wandering on our own way. Well, then we need to ask God, please show us the straight path again. Bring us back onto the path. What's this path? It's the path of those whom you have favored, not the path of those who earn your anger, nor of those who go astray. This is often considered the Quran in a nutshell, this verse. And sometimes the first verse, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, is considered the nutshell of the Fatiha. So, you know, you kind of like, if you want to collapse it to its minimum thing, that's what you would do. But I have a, this system here, sound system isn't that great, but I have a recording here of the Surah Fatiha. We'll just listen
to it.
Recitation is like. This is a fairly unadorned style of Quranic recitation. There's also more elaborate styles, but there's a lot more.
So that is a melodic chant rather yes. than speaking.
Yes, yes. It's always chanted. And that would be the sort of unadorned version, and then there would be more elaborate versions that could be chanted at special occasions. In fact, there are this kind of Quranic recitation on discs or tapes is very popular in Muslim countries. They sell there are famous Quran reciters whose, you know, CDs sell like pop star CDs. I mean, they're very famous, and they can pack a football stadium for a Quranic recitation. The difference is you don't have to pay to go to a Quranic recitation. It's always sponsored. Somebody will sponsor Quranic recitation, and then everybody's invited for free. All right, but that's important. Again, it's hearing, you know, hearing it. When you go to Quran school as a kid, the first thing you learn is how to memorize and recite the Quran. You don't sit down and sort of talk about, well, what does this mean or anything, because you want to hear it and be able to recite it. Well, the thing that I'm going to go on to do in our remaining time together is to look at a story that we have in the Bible, and we also have it in the Quran, because one of the things that's interesting about the Quran, and it's surprising often for people, for Christians to read, is a lot of characters you meet, you know them. You meet Adam, you meet Noah, and Abraham, and Moses, and Jesus, and John the Baptist, and Zechariah. And all these people, they're all talked about in the Quran, and there's some stories, and Joseph, I mentioned, you know. So it's really interesting. There are a lot of parallels in terms of some of the stories told in the Quran and the stories told in the Bible. So we're going to look at one of those. But before we do that, I just wondered if, you know, I've sort of babbled and shown a lot of things, and I haven't given you a turn to kind of ask questions to clarify this or anything about this. Yeah.
Well,
I don't know. I think it's not that maybe it's too big a question, but we know the Judeo-Christian connection pretty well, I think, mm-hmm. as Christians. And we know that the Jews have not accepted Christ as Savior. How would you contrast that, or is it similar with the...
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a connection because, as you'll see, many of these Quranic stories are so sparse that it's almost assumed that there was wider knowledge of these stories around. Like, there might be a story of Noah, and it seems apparent, if you just had the Quranic telling, you wouldn't have enough details to make sense of it. So it seems to be that in the environment in which the Quran was revealed and Islam started, that there was some knowledge of a lot of these biblical stories and personages. It's a historical question about how many Jews and Christians lived in the Arabian Peninsula at the time, but there's some knowledge of that. So there's that connection. As far as you were referring to this specific thing about Jews, you know, coming out of the same background as Christians, but the difference is that Jesus is not accepted as a Messiah or as a Son of God. Their Jews and Muslims are very close, because the reason given often for that rejection, particularly after Christians start talking about Jesus as part of the Trinity, is that it sort of, how can you be monotheistic and believe in? And that's the same kind of thing about Muslims. There's a lot of positive things in the Quran about Christians. Christians and Jews are considered peoples who have had valid revelations and who are monotheists and so on. But then, you know, why do you have that Trinity thing, right? You know, and there's sort of this stuff in the Quran that says, well, don't say that God's three, you know, and Jesus isn't, you know, he's a prophet sent by God, but he's not. If you say he's the Son of God, well, then your monotheism is kind of in thrown into question. So that's the kind of same connection that they would have.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry.
Two questions. What was the rough period of time between the revelations and the spoken word and then writing down the Quran? Mm-hmm. And is there any dispute among Islamic clerics about the true copy text?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Muhammad started having the revelations about 610, and they continued to almost his death in 632. So over that time, the various revelations came. They were largely kept in oral form. Now, the Muslim version of this text is that even already that time, various people might have copied parts of them down. But under one of the under the first successor of Muhammad, Abu Bakr, there was a sort of concern to start consolidating this, because what happened is people started getting some variant readings, where there'd be some verses that somebody else didn't have, or different pronunciation of certain words. But that didn't come to its culmination, according to Muslim tradition, until the third successor of Muhammad, Uthman, and he would have been probably or like around 650s, okay, so not that long after Muhammad's death. And it's said, according to tradition, that he put together a normative exemplar of the Quran and kind of wanted everybody else to get rid of any other variant copies. And that this sort of normative exemplar has come down and been transmitted virtually intact from that time, okay? Now, there's been some variant readings, because that exemplar was just with the consonantal text. If, you know, Semitic languages are written with consonants, okay? The vowels, you put little marks, little dots, and things around it. Well, it's the same with Arabic, same thing. So in the early times, just like the Jews, they didn't point their text either. Arabs didn't either. You just knew what was the right thing. You know, just learned that. But it's possible at certain points, if you put different vowels in, you get slightly different meanings or slightly different words. So that didn't come in for several centuries and afterwards. So there were like 8 or 9 canonical readings that were recognized where there were some variants, but they didn't really affect the meaning that much. Now, that's sort of the standard traditional Orthodox Muslim explanation. Western scholars working outside of Islam, some of them have questioned the story, just like has happened in Christianity, where some have said, well, maybe, you know, this period was longer than Muslims say, and that there may have been more variants, and that some of the material was collated later, and some may have come from who knows what source. sometimes that scholarship, unfortunately, has come from an anti-Muslim stance. It's been done by people who wanted, before they even did the research, to discredit Islam. The other thing, though, is that when the Christian and Jewish scriptures were put together, there wasn't the same kind of concern about having the text be exactly the same. I mean, that just didn't exist till later on. By the time that we have Islam arising, people were into that mindset much more, that texts have to be copied exactly and they have to stay the same. So there is probably some truth to the traditional Muslim explanation, growing up in that environment, that there would, from early on, now how early on is the argument, be a desire to keep the text exactly the same through the generations. So there is not a lot of that kind of investigation or discussion among Muslims. It's just generally assumed to be an uncorrupted, pure text handed down untouched from the beginning.
There isn't a collection of a few chapters that are held up.
No, there's very little kind of textual material or manuscripts. There was going to be some German scholars were going to try to do that, and they collected some stuff. We don't know really what it was, because during World War II, this was all warehoused in Munich, and when Munich was bombed, all the material they had collected went up in smoke and everything. So, but there probably, even if there was something, the variants probably wouldn't all be that great, because again, so much was in that mindset that, you know, there probably aren't the same kind of variants that we find with the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament. Okay, shall we? I'd like to go on and just read the story very quickly and do that. And certainly there can be a lot more time for questions, too. I don't want to short-circuit that. I just want to make sure that we have the time to do this. Now, the story that I'm going to use is the story of the sacrifice of Isaac. Okay? And just to refresh your memory on this, it's in Genesis chapter 22. And a lot of us probably, you know, we sort of know the story, but I'm just going to translate it very quickly from the Hebrew text here, just so we kind of get what the story is about. And after these things, you know, he sort of asked, well, what things preceded this? What happened just before this in the Hebrew text is that Isaac is born to Sarah. She's been barren, and she gets kind of antsy about this other child that's in the household, Ishmael, and she has Abraham kick Ishmael and his mother Hagar out. Okay, so that's basically what's happening before this time. So after these things, God tested Abraham. Now that's very important, because we're given privilege of knowing as readers or hearers of this text that this is going to be a test. We'll find out Abraham doesn't know this is going to be a test. But God tested Abraham. And God said to him, Abraham, and he said, here am I. And he said, take please your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. Okay, sort of a neat run, like it's as if Abraham's not getting it. Your son, oh, well, which one? Well, who? Well, your only son. Oh, the one you love, Abraham. You know, Isaac, finally, you get to the name. Well, that's kind of interesting. First of all, I mean, I would raise the question here. I mean, is this really true? Is Isaac Abraham's only son? I don't know whether that expulsion is meant to mean that, or are we given to understand that Ishmael's been written off and is not considered a son of Abraham anymore. So anyways, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him up there as a whole burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell you. Imagine if you got a word from God that said to take your child, such your only child if it is, and to offer him up, to sacrifice him. What's Abraham's response? He got up early in the morning, he saddled his donkey, and he took two young men, maybe of his servants or something, with him, and his son, and Isaac his son. So he doesn't seem to hesitate. Now, why does the text say, and he rose up early in the morning to do this?
He didn't hesitate.
He doesn't hesitate. So that's sort of like maybe he got it in a dream or a vision at night, and as soon as he woke up, he goes, okay, that's one good explanation.
Get it over with.
Get it over with, yeah. I often wonder who's missing in this story.
Sarah,
do you think she's going to let her son? Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of interpreting it here, but you know, it emphasized, you know, like he's going to get up early there and get out before she's, hey, where are you going, you know, and all that stuff, and he's not going to have a chance to go. So he gets up early and he just takes to his young men and he takes his son.
Isaac's not a little boy, though, at this point.
His son Isaac, yeah. Well, it's there's sort of variant ways where Isaac, but most likely he's about 14 years old.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and he chopped the wood for the whole burnt offering, and he set out, and he went to the place, and he started out for the place which God told him. And on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes, and he saw the place from a distance. And he said, and Abraham said to his young men, his youth, youths, stay here with the donkey, and I and the youth, he uses the same word as his knight. You know, why doesn't he say I and my son? He says, no, I and the boy, you know, the youth, we'll go over there, and we will worship, and we will return to you. You know, what's going, I mean, is, what's going, why does he say, I mean, is he serious about doing what God wants him to do? He says, we will return. We will worship, and we will return. I mean, you can read that in a number of ways. Was he so strong in faith, he knows, oh, I know at the last minute God's going to do something. We know that, of course, because we know the story, but think about it, if he hadn't developed this, what's he doing there? Or is he thinking, I know at the last minute my nerve's going to fail. I will not be able to obey this command of God, and we will return to you. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting question.
Or maybe even, that's what I'm going to tell the servants so they won't stop me.
Well, maybe, yeah. There's all kinds of things. You know, see how that's just fruitful here, eh? And he took Abraham took the wood of the whole burnt offering, and he placed it upon Isaac, his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the slaughtering knife. And they went, the two of them, together. And so you got this picture. Father and son walking along the wood. Father, son carrying the wood. Of course, this has been interpreted by Christians as a figure of Christ then, right? Carrying the wood of the cross. Okay. Where were we here? The two of them. And they went, the two of them, together. Okay, they're going along. And Isaac says to Abraham, his father, and he spoke to Abraham, his father, and he said, my father, and Abraham, ever dutifully responds, here I am, my son. He calls him my son now, but they're out of earshot of anybody else, they're by themselves. And he said, that is, Isaac said, look, here's the fire and the wood, but where is the sheep or the lamb for the whole burnt offering? Good question. Started something odd about this. And Abraham said, God will provide or will see to it for a lamb for the whole burnt offering, my son. Now, notice how you can read that. God will provide a lamb for the whole burnt offering, my son. You see how you can read it that way? As if he's revealing to Isaac in sort of a very roundabout way, you're the lamb for the whole burnt offering. I mean, you could read it that way. Okay, and they went, the two of them, together. Again, this poignant portrait of them walking on together. And they came, or they entered, to the place which God had told them. And Abraham built an altar, and he arranged the wood, and he bound Isaac, his son, and placed him upon the altar on top of the wood. Okay, he bound this son. The verb there is akad, and that's why in Jewish tradition this story is called the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. So something that's very important about this binding. Why?
Can't get away.
Can't get away, maybe, yeah.
There doesn't appear to be any struggle.
No, no. But maybe he jumped on them and bound them up after he got everything built? No. But then nothing's described. I mean, it's just described that he is bound. I mean, maybe just to make sure that he doesn't flinch. You know, I don't know. But this is a very important part of the story, especially when you contrast it now with the other version. And Abraham stretched forth his hand, and he took the slaughtering knife to slaughter his son. So you got this picture, and there's all these famous paintings, you know, of him with his knife upstretched. And at the height of this climactic moment, an angel of Yahweh, or an angel of God, called to him from the heavens. I don't know why it's an angel all of a sudden, but an angel is, you know, sort of God has to hide behind an angel. He's maybe embarrassed about what he's, you know, gotten him this far. I don't know. I just, you know, why is an angel here, okay? And he said, Abraham, Abraham, two times this time, because he really had to get his attention before that. The hand came down. And Abraham answered, Here am I. And he said to him, Do not stretch forth your hand towards the youth. Again, this that word's youth. And do not do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God. For you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Okay, so Abraham's passed the test. God wasn't, taking this literally, God wasn't quite sure of Abraham's commitment. And now he knew Abraham's commitment. And Abraham lifted his eyes, again, he sort of looks up like he did before, and he saw, and he looked, and look, there was a ram behind. A ram behind, this very odd kind of wording, like behind somehow, with its horns caught in the thicket, and he went. Abraham went and he took the ram and he offered it up as a whole burnt offering instead of his son. Okay. So you have a substitution of an animal sacrifice for a human sacrifice. And some people think, well, what this is reflecting is human sacrifice used to be a practice in many parts of the world. And this is reflecting a transition from that practice to substituting animals for it. And Abraham called the name of that place Yahweh, or God, will provide. And to this day, it is said, on the mountain of Yahweh, it will be provided. That's usually how it's translated. And then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time, and he said, indeed, I swear by myself, oracle of the Lord, that because you have done this thing, and you have not withheld your son, your only son, therefore I will indeed bless you, and I will multiply your seed, that is your descendants, as the stars of the heavens and as the sand upon the shore of the sea, and your seed will possess the gate of his enemy or their enemy. And furthermore, in your descendants, or in your seed, all the goyim, all the goys, the nations, the non-Jews, will bless themselves because you listened, or you obeyed my voice. Okay, and then we have the ending of the story. And Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and they went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt in Beersheba. Who's missing here?
Sarah.
Oh, who else is missing here? And I'm going to say it again. And Abraham arose and went to his, you know, Abraham returned to his young men. Yeah.
We'll do this again.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, he doesn't appear. He doesn't appear. And the next time he appears in the story, in terms of his father, Abraham is to bury his father. He's died. Okay, he has no, there's no, I mean, that doesn't mean there was an interaction, but there was no mention in the Bible of him. Now, the very interesting thing is Abram settles in Beersheba. That's a place of seven wells, okay? And I'm just going to, I want a little another bit because you mentioned Sarah. There's a little bit of genealogy stuff that comes in about some relatives back in the old country, Mesopotamia. But in chapter 23, we have this stuff about Sarah suddenly comes, appears again. And the years of Sarah's life were 127 years. And Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, in a place of four, town of four or something, that it means that. In Kiryat Arba, which is to say Hebron is another word, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to bury her. That's the next thing you hear about Sarah. There's all kinds of Jewish traditions about how Sarah dropped dead upon hearing what Sarah, what Abraham had done to her son Isaac. You know, all kinds of things. So this is a test. Did Abraham pass the test? Did this make things better? You know, what about this dysfunctional family that's all split up and everything? These are important questions, eh? You know, who is it a test of? You know, these are questions we can raise. Now, I'm going to show you the Quranic account, and we'll read that very quickly together. And just want you to notice, you know, a lot of the points of similarity and the points of difference. And see whether we can learn something from this other version that helps us with what with what we're familiar with. Okay, now this begins sort of in the middle of the story. He said, this is Abraham, I will go to my Lord, he will surely guide me. Because the little episode that happens ahead of this is something we don't have in our Bible. It's about the dispute that Abraham had with his father and his relatives back there in Ur of the Chaldeans where he lived before God. You remember God told Abraham, chapter 12, get up and take your family and go off. Well, a lot of people said, well, you know, what was going on that brought that about? And so both in Jewish tradition and in Muslim tradition, you have all these delightful stories about how the people at the time were all polytheists and Abraham decided, no, there's only one God, and they got really mad at him and he finally got up and left. So you have the story just ahead of this about him disputing with his, with the people of the region about, you know, they have all these idols set up, and he's saying, well, you know, can they answer you? Can they speak? There's even a story in another part of the Quran where he, you know, he argues with the people, and they say, you know, just stop blathering. So at night he goes in and he smashes all the idols up except for the one big one in the middle. And then the people come in the morning and they go, oh, whoa, what's happened here? And he says, well, ask this guy. Ask the head honcho here to tell you what happened. You know, and of course they go, well, he can't speak. And he goes, well, duh, you know, like, why are you worshiping him then? You know, so there's all this kind of stuff. Well, that's all happened. But anyways, he finally has to go. He has to make an emigration. You know, just like Moses had to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt, Abraham has to go. Or just like Muhammad took the first Muslim community from Mecca to Medina. This kind of emigration pattern is deeply ingrained. So he said, I will go to my Lord. He will surely guide me. And then continues, oh my Lord, grant me a righteous one. Now it says son, but it, you know, just says one who's righteous. So we, and this is God, whenever there's sort of this plural capitalized, this is God speaking, the Quran's the plural of majesty. It's like God in the creation story saying, let us create humanity in our image. You know, it's this idea. Okay, so we gave him the good news of a boy ready to suffer and forbear. Well, it's actually a patient, mild son, okay, a boy. Actually, the words are really interesting because ghulam, which is the boy, it really means a child who's right at the age of sexual maturity and is full of churning hormones and all that sort of stuff. Yet, you know, he's mild and mild-tempered and gentle and patient and so on, okay? So he's going to get this child. So he has this child. Then when the son reached the age of serious work with him, okay? In other words, when the child was old enough to actually get out and work with his father, and then when he was old enough to think and make decisions and sort of have his own will, Abraham says to him, oh, my son, I've had this vision. I've seen a vision, or in a dream, the word could be done, that I need to offer you in sacrifice. Now, what do you think of that? Okay, what do you think of that?
At least he's up front about it.
Yeah. Well, the son answers, he says, "Oh, my father, do as you are commanded. You will find me, if Allah so wills, if God so wills, one who practices patience and constance." Okay, now, you know, we don't know when this happened. Did Abraham have this dream, you know, a long time ago, and finally when his son was old enough, he could speak to him about it, but he didn't do anything until he spoke to his son. And, you know, is Abraham wavering here a bit? And his son's going, steadfast, you know, you do what God tells you to do. I'm right. I'm willing to submit to whatever God's will is. Okay.
So are we talking about Isaac now?
What do you think? Abraham's son. We don't know, right? The Quran does not name the son here. That's a very important observation. I'm glad you saw that. Okay? So when they had both submitted their wills to Allah, and that means the term for that is where the term Muslim comes from, a submitter to God. When they had both kind of been small M Muslims, submitted their wills to Allah, and he had laid him, that is, Abram had laid him, or actually thrown him down on prostrate on his forehead to sacrifice him. Now, that's very important. Both submitted their wills to God, and Abraham put him down to sacrifice him. We called out to him, that's God speaking, "Oh, Abraham, you have already fulfilled the vision. You've already come to the purpose of this. Thus, indeed, do we reward those who do right." For this was obviously a trial. See, we're told in this version of the story at the end that it was a trial. Whereas in the biblical account, right at the beginning, we're told God tested Abraham. And told him that this was obviously a trial. And we ransomed him, that is, Isaac, with a momentous sacrifice. Okay, that's about the only allusion you get that there was a substitution. Okay, that somehow Isaac wasn't sacrificed, or the son, sorry, I'm putting the name in here, and that's very, see how automatically I do that, right? That the son something was substituted, a momentous sacrifice. It, you know, that's so elusive, you'd have to know the biblical account to know what that is. It might mean something more general. We might say, instead of the sacrifice of the son, the way you people were willing to sacrifice your own wills for God's will, that's the most momentous sacrifice. That's another way that this could be interpreted. And we're almost done here. And we left this blessing for him among generations to come in later times. So now they're summing up the story. This story comes as a series of stories about Noah, about Moses, Noah, then Abraham, then Moses, then Elijah, and then Lot or somebody else. Sort of a series of four or five scenarios about being faithful. And they all end in the same way. We've left this story, we've left this following blessing upon him so that people who are coming after would be able to say this. Peace and salutation to Abraham. Peace be upon Abraham. Thus indeed do we reward those who do right, for he was one of our believing servants. And we gave, and that's sort of the kind of refrain that ends each of these stories about these prophets. And then he had a little bit of extra material here, which I decided to add. And we gave him, this is still talking about Abraham, the good news. Now that sort of repeats that previous phrase where we gave him the good news of a son. But here we have the name, the good news of Isaac, a prophet, one of the righteous. We blessed him and Isaac, but of their progeny, in other words, of their descendants, there are some that do right, but there are some that obviously do wrong to their own souls. In other words, to their own self-detriment. So I don't know who do you think the whole story of the sacrifice, which son was involved there?
There's no way to tell.
There's no way to tell. Somebody said Ishmael? Okay. I mean, the son is not named, and the earliest Muslim commentators were divided on whether it was Isaac and Ishmael, but eventually the consensus that was settled on in Islam is that the son who was almost sacrificed was Ishmael. Okay? It was Ishmael, and therefore, when you come to this verse 112, it's sort of seen as sequential. And then we gave him the good news of another son, that is Isaac, who is a prophet and one of the righteous. Because both Isaac and Ishmael are equally held up in the Quran as models of faithful submitters to God, as prophets who led their people and so on. Without really a lot of distinction being made between the two. They have different, somewhat different stories, but they aren't differentiated among. Whereas the biblical account is very clear on saying that the promise is not going to go through Ishmael, so there's the expulsion of Ishmael, and the focus is on Isaac. Right? And Muslims often point to this, you know, the biblical account where it says, take your son, your only son, and say, well, the only time when Abraham had an only son was the 14 years that he had Ishmael before Isaac was born. So they say, well, you know, your scriptures got kind of screwed up somewhere along the way. This is a more original version, all right? So, but, you know, it's not clear literally who's what son is meant, which is which is to say that for the Quran, it's not important. You know, it's not, it's immaterial really in a sense whether it's Isaac or Ishmael, that's this model of submission. So who's being tested in, or on trial or tested in this version of the sacrifice of Abraham's son?
Both the father and the son.
Both the father and the son, and that's really clear. I mean, you might want to say that, maybe that's true of the biblical account, but you might never have thought of that. Because there's no direct clue in the biblical account for that. I mean, Isaac, you know, sort of acquiesces. He asks that question, so he has a little bit of volition, but not a lot. Whereas in this account, you know, his dad, like, you know, in the biblical account, Isaac asks his dad, you know, here's the fire, here's the, and all the stuff and the wood, but where's the lamb? And Abraham has to answer. And he actually answers, you know, with kind of a very faithful response, if we take it as being genuine, God's going to provide, you know, please God provide something, right? But he has that kind of trust. But in this account, it's Abraham who asks Isaac a question, or the son a question, I should say. Here's this dream I had, what do you think of it? And then Isaac comes back with a response that, you know, could be interpreted as solidifying Abraham's resolve to go ahead with what God's been telling him to do.
I always thought that Isaac was kind of placid.
In which, the biblical?
Yeah.
In the biblical account, yeah.
How is Ishmael portrayed?
Ishmael's portrayed also as, now there's not a lot of narrative about Ishmael in the Quran. Like, you don't find his mother, Hagar. Well, Sarah, you know, who else is missing in this story? There's no mention of Sarah. In fact, Sarah doesn't appear as a character in the Quran at all. Neither does Ishmael's mother. Ishmael is just portrayed as a prophet who helped Abraham build the Kaaba, the central focus of Muslim worship in Mecca, and a few other little details.
Are there many women mentioned in the Quran? Is that typical?
Well, there is one chapter of the Quran that's named after a woman, and it's Maryam, Mary. And Mary, Jesus' mother, is extremely prominent in the Quran, very prominent.
How does the Quran deal with Ishmael separating out from the family or disseparating?
It doesn't have that account in it. But it's become part of Muslim tradition that he and his mother went out, and but Abraham didn't leave them, forsaken, would visit them, and they just lived in a different place. And then from Ishmael, it's believed then that the Arabs came from.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the line that Muhammad's traced back. But the Quran doesn't give any indication of importance of that.
Why, as Christians, are we more comfortable with the Jewish, because it's the beginning of our arrival, than we are with Islam, with the Muslim, because it's after?
Probably because it came after.
And
there wasn't supposed to be anything that came after,
we
right?
We didn't hear the next chapter.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But are they all Can you say that they are together, or are they?
There's strong linkages between them. There's certain distinct differences between Christianity and Islam, just as there are between Christianity and Judaism. You can't pretend it's otherwise. But, you know, we can certainly see these strong kinship lines, strong linkages between these different that we can learn from to appreciate and maybe learn something about our own faith as well from them. Now, I know Vespers is coming, and it's very important for us to all go there. But I'm certainly, if you have questions, I'm here just till the slow boat bus in the afternoon, in early afternoon. So I'd certainly be welcome. If you want to ask any questions or anything, please don't hesitate to ask me questions and so on. I'm sorry, we don't have more time right now. Yes, yes, that's a very interesting interpretation.
And that some people that refuse to believe in a God
who would child abuse.
And all of those.
Yes, yes, yeah. And I think those are powerful statements, because it is true. I mean, if you have a story of a God who calls a faithful servant to kill his child, you know, that sounds like a really bad model of parenting, doesn't it? You know, and if some person is a little bit unbalanced or something, could easily get it into their heads to do something like that. That's pretty scary. So,
I mean, it does,
for us, with our sensibilities, it really puts the whole character of God into question for us too, and makes us think about that. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Well, thank you. You're welcome.